Blog Talk Radio.
At 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 o'clock Pacific Time, and 8 p.m. UK Time. And to all our listeners from around the world, the number to ring the show is 347-539-5367. And from the UK, 001-347-539-5367. And 5367, and the chat room is open. Well, we've got a really good show tonight, but I just want to mention a good friend of mine. He's just got a book out. It came out on about the June the 7th. It's called, if you like mysteries, UFOs, big cats, werewolves, well, he's brought this book out called The Truth That Leaves No Proof. Truth Proof. And it's by the author of Paul Sinclair. He lives in Bridlington, very local to me. He's a good friend of mine as well. And you can buy it on Amazon. So I've had a good look at it. It's a fantastic read. What a lovely book, and a true one of the best investigators I've known. Very thorough, whatever he does. He takes his time, but what a book. It's amazing. Go on Amazon and just put his name in, Paul Sinclair. The Truth That Leaves No Proof, and I'm sure you'll find a lot of people that's wrote a good write-up about it. Well, on today's show, it's a good friend of mine, Jeff Krause, and he wants to talk about why is California the UFO global hotspot in the States? We've been wondering about that for years, but it sounds like it's really, really one of those places where there's lots of them in June and July. There's quite a lot of them. Can we please welcome Jeff to the show? Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Bob, how are you today? Thanks for having me on again.
Well, I'm okay, thank you very kindly. Yes, you know, we talk about California being the hot spot. It's just
well, it definitely
amazing.
Is. It definitely is, Bob. And good evening to all your listeners out there. For any of you that aren't familiar with me, I'm the state director for Southern California for MUFON. And MUFON is the Mutual UFO Network. We're the world's leading scientific investigators of UFOs. And here's some, just a few statistics I want to run by you people for last year. Number of sightings we had in the U.S. in total, number of sighting reports that came into MUFON. And Bob, these are cases that were actually all investigated by our dedicated field investigators.
Yes.
We had 8,621 reports come in for 2015. Can you believe that? That is a staggering number.
That is a lot. To digest
that really
and,
is.
And to look into it, it must take a lot of time.
It does. We have some very dedicated people that are field investigators for MUFON. They put forward a lot of their time and a lot of their resources checking into these reports. And every case, every report that's filed with MUFON gets the same amount of attention, no matter what it is. So, yes, everyone puts in an incredible amount of time to solve these cases. But, you know, what's really staggering, out of that 8,621 cases, California had 1,249 of them. And that is just phenomenal. That is well over an eighth. And we have 50 states, plenty of other areas where the attention could be. But for some particular reason, and this is a trend that has been going on for years, Bob, Southern California, the global hotspot for UFOs.
And what, you know, Jeff, we talk about this, but why do you think it is? Is it because the government places around the area, or is it the air bases?
Well, we have to look at it from, of course, the human standpoint, how we would approach it instead of the alien standpoint, because we don't know their interests. But we do know what would interest us if we were going someplace we hadn't been before. First of all, we'd see the large mass of people there that we could see by all the lights and obviously power to all these people in one place. And that's got to be something that sticks out from space to get someone's attention right there. But were they to come closer, what would they see there? Well, they'd see a lot of industry along the coastline, a lot of shipyards, airports, and a few military bases as well. And these, of course, would be things of interest to them, no matter who they would be. Of course, you're a new person coming to a new land. These are the kinds of things that, you know, catch your attention because they're big, they're bright, they have lots of power going into them. So that could be one simple explanation right there. But, of course, you know, Southern California is way more complex than that. We have a couple of nuclear power plants there. One's been deactivated. San Onofre is no longer in operation. Very glad to see an aging one retired in the way it was because, you know, we don't want any accidents to happen.
No.
It provided a lot of great power for many years, but it reached its retirement age, and they did the responsible thing, taking it offline and retiring it in a very safe manner. So I'm very glad to see that one go. The one that's just on the other side of the hill from me, however, is still going. That's Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. And, you know, we have had many reports in the area here of San Luis Obispo. I'm sure you're familiar with my slow UFO article.
Yes.
And what's amazing is the date that that sighting occurred, which was July 7th, 1967, was the very same day that PG&E signed the contract to begin work building PG&E nuclear, Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. So is there a correlation? We don't know, but there's definitely a coincidence. And, well, you know, I don't really believe in coincidences, so who knows? Maybe it was something going on the same day that was tied in. It obviously was a big enough case to where AFOSI was interested in it, it also became a Project Blue Book case. So, you know, when we finally determine what happened there is maybe another clue as to whether it's tied into the nuclear industry straight off. But, you know, many reports have come in of UFOs over nuclear reactors, so it's not unheard of to have it be related in some remote fashion. You know, it's very possible. So we have nuclear power plants in the state that, of course, energy is always, according to many reports, it's always a thing that attracts UFOs.
Yeah.
There are hundreds and hundreds of reports of UFOs hovering over power lines and what some would say them drawing energy off them. And if you think of all the miles of high-voltage power lines strung around California, that could be one thing possibly that they're coming after. But then there's also some very peculiar industries going on in Southern California. Southern California especially is concentrating with a lot of defense industries. So we have them tied in with other major military installations such as Edwards Air Force Base and MCAS El Toro. Also, there's Miramar down in San Diego. So we have a lot of technology going on around a lot of military activity at the same time. That's got to be of interest to anyone flying over the area from out of town because, well, you'd want to know if you were keeping tabs on any kind of a civilization,
that's
what their progress
it.
Was in those areas. That's just
that's
logical.
True. Well, it is. It is when you think about it. It's like, it's like the Russians coming over to the States and having a look and say, hey, look at that. They've got this here. They've got that there. Why is that there? So it's understandable.
Absolutely.
But the aliens, if they're coming down, they're looking around, they're probably wanting some energy to reactivate their
many people say it's human nature to be curious. But I would say it's also just nature in general. Many species are curious about things, and I would see no reason why a species from somewhere else would not have the same curiosity. Perhaps that's why they're either A, traveling around, or B, have a base nearby to keep tabs on us, or perhaps even C, have bases here, say, under the oceans or remote locations, underground, anywhere at all, practically. For all we know, they might have been here for a very long time, maybe even before us. So,
I'm sure,
you know,
I'm sure they have
bases,
Jeff, as well. I'm sure they've got bases in a lot of seas underground and the North Pole and various other places where they can appear out of anywhere.
And we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the many cases that are reported of aliens working hand-in-hand with terrestrials and military forces in deep underground military bases and things like that. In fact, just yesterday, Bob, this will really give you a smile, I interviewed an individual whose mother was one of Howard Hughes' private secretaries.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
She worked in a deep underground military base out in the desert with an elevator that went down and down and down to about a mile below the desert floor, a deep underground military installation. She worked with Wernher von Braun personally. He knew her and called her by a pet name he had for her. And of course, you know, she validated to her son that, yes, there was an ET presence on the planet. And, yes, they were possibly working in. She didn't tend to think that they were all that nice. In fact, the general impression that she gave her son was that they were not. So, you know, that kind of fits in with some other stories I've heard. And I thought maybe you might get a kick out of that. But, again, we're talking Southern California. And
again,
it's a very expanse area, you know, with an area of 163,694.74 square miles. That's a lot of area for aliens and whoever to hide in. We, of course, are the third largest state, Alaska being the largest and Texas the second largest. So, you know, the size alone is going to probably contribute to us having more sightings than other places, because
yes.
you know, you have a larger net, you're going to catch more fish. But we also have some geographic oddities that might cause attention from visitors from afar. Say the San Andreas Fault, which of course stretches the length of California for roughly 700 or 800 miles. And it has an average depth of 10 miles. It's thought to be about 28 million years old. So I'm sure that they've been maybe keeping tabs on that for quite a while to see what kind of geographic changes that might bring about, or catastrophes. And maybe, you know, who knows, maybe they warned other civilizations previously of events that might occur along it. We just don't know. But we do know that the Chumash, who lived in this area, left many cave paintings along the Channel Islands and different places around the Santa Barbara area of strange large-headed beings and flying objects. So, and of course, their civilization lasted for around 60,000 years, and it existed a long, long time ago. For them to have seen these things is, you know, quite fantastic. And to have a record of it in the caves is remarkable.
Exactly. Can you just give us an insight into the aliens in the forest?
Well, you know, unfortunately, Mr. Shrum just passed away a few months ago.
Oh.
It's kind of sad. He was the individual who fought off the aliens in an all-night encounter. In case anyone's not familiar with the case, a very good book to read on it, written by my friends Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte, called Aliens in the Forest. It deals with the 1964 case of Mr. Donald Shrum in the forest near Cisco Grove. And he endured through a horrific 12-hour struggle with aliens. And they seemed like they were just intent on taking him away in what he thought would be a fate worse than death. And only really his quick wit and skills as a hunter saved him and allowed him to defeat the attackers. He actually at one point fought off aliens with a bow and arrow. Now, how cool is that? You know,
that's
if that
cool.
shouldn't be made into a movie, I don't know what should, because that really happened. J. Allen Hynek even had one of his arrows on his desk. This case was investigated by Project Blue Book. The Air Force took extreme interest in this, even going out to the remote location. But poor Mr. Shrum was out hunting with a couple of his other buddies, and they got, you know, they went in different directions for the night. And he's far away. You know, he started seeing this light coming around. He thought, well, maybe it's a helicopter looking for him. Maybe they thought he was lost or something. And he already had his campfire going for the evening. So he kind of stood up and started waving his arms to signal him. And right about the time this large object started turning around and coming towards him, he realized, oh, crap, that's not a helicopter. That's not a plane. That's some kind of weird craft. And, you know, that's when he saw the different windows and portals along the side of it and everything. And about that time, other objects came out of it. And so he started kicking out his campfire and trying to put it out as fast as it can. And he saw one of the objects come down and a couple of entities come out of it. And to make a long story short, he climbed up a tree and tied himself in with an ammo belt he had so that he was secured up in the tree. And he fought them off all night long. Even at one point when he ran out of arrows, he resorted to lighting pine cones and bits of the tree and then tearing strips of his cloth, his clothes into strips, and lighting it on fire and throwing it down at them. Until finally two of the entities, one of them appeared like a robot, and another one came down from the ship after he'd fought them off for a long time. And together they stood next to each other face to face, and some kind of sparks flew and this gas came up and knocked him out, and that was the last he remembered until he came to in the morning, and he was hanging by his belt in the tree, and all the entities, aliens and robots, whatever they were all gone at that point, and he was still there, so he made it through the night. One of my favorite cases, very fascinating, and anybody that would like to read about it further, you can order that book through roswellbooks.com, and it's a fascinating read, great case. And it's very sad that Mr. Shrum just passed away, because he was really, you know, you can still find videos of him talking about the case on YouTube, fortunately. But, of course, we're always sad when someone passes like that and out of history, there's no longer any way to talk to him anymore. So, it's, you know, glad we had the chance to talk to him when we did. But now we only have the videos and the book to rely on as far as getting any more information on the case.
That's true as well. I think we've got a phone call. We'll just take a phone call. It's a 0919 number. Hello, who's there?
Yeah, hi. Yeah,
hello.
Yeah, great show.
How
are
you?
Can you hear me? Oh,
yeah,
I'm doing fine. Yeah,
would you
wonderful
like to
show.
Ask Jeff a question?
Well, yeah, I'd like to, you know, I hadn't heard of the aliens in the forest. My name's Russ, and Jeff knows
hi,
me.
Russ.
I'm with New Phone. And,
Russ Hasbill. Hey,
yeah,
Russ, how you
me.
Doing?
Super.
Hey, thanks for calling in.
No.
Glad you made it.
Yeah,
it took me a while. I'm still learning how to do the Facebook and all the other stuff. So anyway, but I did get here. But, yeah, I was wondering if maybe Jeff could tell us about more. Now, this is at California, but the one where the people fought off the aliens in, I think it was Kentucky or Tennessee. Do you know about that one, Jeff?
I got to admit, I do not. You got me on that one.
Oh, okay. It took place in the 40s or 50s. I think it was Kentucky, but a group of aliens came down, and the family was there, like, having a dinner or something, and they fought them off. They sent a runner, and I think they got the sheriff, and the sheriff, you know, basically they were trying to break in. It looked like something out of a horror movie, but, you know, they did an investigation, and, kind of very similar. They fought them off. They were using guns, but they were trying to break into this house, and they fought them off for the night, and ultimately they won. Well, I don't know if they won, but it's at least the aliens didn't get them.
Well, they're still there to talk about it. So, hey, that's fascinating, Russ. Thanks for bringing that up. And you know what? If you could email me a link to that story or any information on it, I'd really love to read about that. That sounds great.
Yeah, be glad to. Yeah, I've been fascinated by it and trying to find out more information on it because I guess the Air Force came out too again and investigated it, and you know they were very interested in it. But it sounds like the real deal.
You know how much I love the Blue Book cases, Russ.
Yeah, me too. but I'm sure that was one of the more fascinating cases.
Yes, I'm sure it is as well, and I'm sure Jeff can tell us another case, what's happened.
Oh, well, you know, like I said, California being the leader in them, yeah, we got a bazillion of them. Of course, I don't know of too many where they were fought off with bows and arrows or with guns. Plenty of them where people shot at the craft. In fact, we can go back to probably the most famous of them when we go to February 25th, 1942, and what's been known as the Battle of Los Angeles, when, you know, there were so many rounds fired up in the sky that it's a miracle more people didn't die by the stuff falling down from our own forces. But apparently some craft were seen. And, of course, this is right after the bombing Pearl Harbor just a couple months previously. So we had war jitters and anything odd up in the sky, we tended to want to fire at and bring down. And that's kind of what's odd about this, and you can even see in the picture of it. There was a picture in the article I sent to you as well of it.
Yes.
All the beams of light focused on this one object definitely looks like a dish-shaped craft, and yet over 1,000 rounds were fired at it, and it still didn't bring it down. How did that happen?
True.
You know, that had to have been something very strange. And, of course, ever since the atomic bomb, there's been an increase in sightings from that point on, especially many tests. But one of my favorite cases here in California, it's known as the Big Sur case. And this one's really fantastic because some high-tech photo equipment, the type used to track rockets going up into orbit. Remember how in the launches back in the 60s and 70s, they always had a tracking camera tracking the rocket as far up as it could go? Well, this was that type of camera tracking very well. It was set up as Big Sur and was pointed towards Vandenberg Air Force Base.
And when this Titan missile was launched with a nuclear warhead, you know, a dummy warhead, obviously, but still it was a valid test. And apparently the next day, the person after taking the film footage and tracking it was called into the office of the base commander and chewed up one side and the other, wanting to know what it was they videotaped. Well, when the tape was reviewed, an object was seen to come in and hover near the missile while it's flying. Now, how fast does a missile go again? Let's see. Yeah, this UFO hovered around it in perfect pace and fired lasers at it from four different positions around the missile. And then the warhead tumbled off into the ocean, and the rest of the missile was a failure, never made it to its intended target. And they had all this on high-definition film. Oops. Can you imagine the poor trouble the photographer got in just for shooting that?
Oh, God, yes. Serious problems.
Absolutely one of my favorite cases. I would love for the video or the film released of that incident. Many people are aware of it. It's common knowledge that it happened, yet still the Air Force won't release the footage, which would undoubtedly show, you know, exactly what's going on. And you can look at the Rendlesham Forest incident as a little comparison.
Yes.
Beams of light came down in the weapons storage area there to deactivate weapons. We have the incident in 1967 in Malmstrom Air Force Base when the missiles, 10 flights of missiles were deactivated there by a UFO. So perhaps, you know, and this is just a tip of the iceberg, there are hundreds if not thousands of these types of reports, but I'm using, you know, popular ones that are easy for people to look up and verify to make my point here, that perhaps they're trying to send some sort of message that we should not be playing around with nuclear weapons. And, you know, how many times do you need to be told about something that has the potentially disastrous and lethal consequences as that?
Correct. That's so,
you know,
true as well.
It's pretty obvious. Yes. It's pretty obvious, and it should be obvious to the military when they keep getting repeatedly confronted over instances like that, that perhaps they're playing with something they shouldn't.
Hey, yeah, what I was going to ask you was, do you think disclosure will ever happen?
Well, you know, I'm sure you've probably heard me say this before, Bob. I think it's happening one drip at a time right now. Don't expect your leaders of parliament or the president or Congress in the United States to have the balls to stand up and say anything. That's not going to happen. There's not going to be a general announcement saying, yes, we lied, we're sorry, there really is aliens, and we kept it from you. That's never going to happen. What's happening is a slow allowance of the release of information. Now, you got to remember, Bob, back in the day, you talked about this stuff in the 60s or the 70s. You had the FBI, the CIA, or other different groups like that, probably MI6 in your country, knocking on your door wanting to ask questions.
Yes.
This was a matter of national security at the time. It hasn't lost its importance whatsoever. This is still the most important thing to happen to mankind. It hasn't changed at all. What has changed is the ability for people to talk about it openly on TV, on radio, and the different avenues of media that we have these days without the fear of them coming knocking on your door. That has changed,
correct,
and that is a big change right there. You know, so yes, disclosure is going on. It's just they put it in the hands of the people.
Yeah, I remember in, I think it was 1962 or 63, I saw a UFO in the sky, and I reported it to paper. Never thought note of it, and there were a knock on door. I'm from London. I thought, ooh, who's this then? And I had to draw things, I had to explain things. 3 hours going through it all. And when it gone, I said to my mum, where's he come from? The government. We didn't really know a lot. I don't think we asked too many questions, really. I just wanted to get it over with. because I got ridiculed.
It's very intimidating.
Because I was, I think I was 16 or 17 at the time, maybe 18, I can't remember. And it was it just said in the local paper, man sees flying object over Halifax. So when and my name was put by, and when I went into work the day after next, I got ridiculed at work. Yeah, you were drunk at the time. Why did you ring up and all this carry on? I thought, I've never done it. So I presume a lot of people over them years have seen things but don't like to report it.
Right. That was part of the governments on both sides of the ocean's plan to keep from too much attention coming to the subject that they thought had so much importance. It had so much importance to them that they couldn't let the people know how important it was. Otherwise, they could lose control. If people back in the 1940s and 50s knew that there were things flying in and out and doing all this stuff, and we were powerless to do anything about it, they'd have not slept very well at night. I mean, face it, you know, right after the war like that, everyone was still a little nervous and wondering what could happen. There's all those sci-fi movies in the 50s of alien invasion and taking over the Earth. So, yeah, you know, it could be seen that people would be a little bit scared of things like that coming out at the time. But since then, the American public has learned so many things. Our scientific advances have increased exponentially. We now carry around in our smartphones the equivalent of the computer that landed man on the moon. It's more powerful than that by exponential leaps and bounds. So, yeah, things have changed quite a bit. The way we can communicate has changed. Instant messaging with someone on the other side of the planet. That was science fiction back when I was younger.
Just
so many of these things that have changed in the way the world communicates, the public opinion. That's why I think now the more that people have learned, the more information that has become available to them, they've been able to come to more intelligent conclusions instead of just taking the fodder that's been fed to them. People actually go out and investigate and look stuff up these days instead of just saying, oh, yeah, that's nice. Yeah. There's still people that do that, but I'm finding that there's a majority out there that's waking up and actually looking and asking questions. And, you know, that's what we want is more people asking questions, getting involved, looking for themselves. Because once you start looking, it's like falling down the rabbit hole. You know, you're going to wind up in Wonderland once you start, because one little bit of information is going to lead to the next. And as soon as you start verifying stuff and looking into it, you're going to go, wow, okay. And you do get sucked in. And I warn everyone listening out there, once you do start investigating, you're going to keep doing it. You'll keep looking stuff up and researching on your own, because you're going to become incredulous at what you thought didn't exist, that it really does. You'll find so much documentation, both civilian and military, to back up these sightings and these things that have occurred that a lot of people aren't aware of. They think, oh, maybe it's just a few drunks at 2 a.m. or some troubled youth seeing these things, which is not the case at all. Military personnel, law enforcement personnel, scientists, astronomers, all kinds of people through all walks of life are seeing UFOs. And, you know, I told you this before, I think on the last show, if witness testimony is good enough to condemn a man for murder, why isn't witness testimony good enough to verify that something strange flew in the sky above someone?
It's strange you're saying that as well. On the news, regular on the news, they'll talk about ISIS doing this and around the world. But I don't know if it's in America, but in the UK, you never hear UFOs mentioned on any of the news programs in the UK. Never, ever.
Yeah. You know, it's improved here. It used to be every UFO story had, you know, some kind of joke attached to it, a smirk, a laugh, a cute, witty aside made by the anchor person. But lately, journalists are taking the subject seriously. I have seen very good, serious interviews and serious reporting done on the subject. So I think even the journalistic field is coming around and realizing that the public is not the idiots that they once thought they were. And we do take the subject very seriously. And perhaps there's a little bit more to it than most people have been led to believe. And obviously there is. I mean, if you look through all the military reports, sure, at first they say, no, this never happens, or no, the Air Force doesn't investigate UFOs. Oh, gosh, and then you write a Freedom of Information request, and what happens? Whoopsie, you get this report of how they investigated UFOs. And
well,
it happens time after time after time.
Where I live on the northeast coast of England, and there's a really big hotspot around that area, and off Flamborough, 60 miles out, there's a, what you call a triangle out there. When you talk,
you're talking
fishermen,
about up towards the Isle of Man.
No,
are you talking about up towards
Head,
the Isle of Man, or
no? We're on the other side, on the northeast coast of England.
Oh, okay, okay.
That's from Hull up to Scarborough, but in between there, there's a place called Flamborough Head. A lot of fishing vessels go out there fishing about 60 miles out. But when you talk to fishermen, they say to you, yeah, we see them regular, UFOs around here. And they reckon there's a triangle going out there where they see regular UFOs. And then a friend of mine who's got his book out, sorry to mention his book again, but he interviewed an old couple who was in a cottage not far away from where I live. It must have been about 20 years ago. And they was looking out one evening and saw about 30 UFOs over the sea, everywhere. They said they were flying around and not in circles, but all around. And then they all vanished. He said the morning after, the beach was full of military people. Absolutely, they were down there looking for something. So it's been seen. Anyway, my mate went to interview her, and he's got it all in his book. Like, but he says, you know, they're an old couple. There's no need to lie or anything. What they saw was there. And it's so strange, but the military was down that beach the morning after, covering everywhere. It was blanked off at both sides, so nobody could go down there at all.
Fascinating.
So they must have seen something on their radars.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that's kind of cool, too, because the military obviously knows that a certain type of radar at a certain strength affects the flight patterns of UFOs. And I've heard reports of them actually using that to try to bring down UFOs before. So the fact that they converged on the beach like that after they had a good, strong radar hit, who knows what more they know about what happened to that craft?
Yes, I'm sure.
Then again, near the ocean, you know, how much of our planet's ocean again, Bob? Can you remind me? Most of it.
Yes.
Most of it.
I think there's more ocean and there is land.
And I think they have a lot more opportunity of being unobserved in their actions, hanging out down there, than they do up here. And
yes,
I'm sure that their craft, the technology they have, as I've heard from different reports, operates exactly the same underwater as it does above water. So nothing inhibiting them there. They could have bases all over that we would never even know about, because we just have no idea what's really going on at the bottom of our oceans. We've barely even investigated down there. We just don't have the technology to go to those depths.
Because they were saying they've seen them around volcanoes, they've seen them all over the place.
Sure.
So
and, you know, maybe
anywhere.
That's a way to go into the earth or something, we don't know. But at the very least, that's a geothermal energy source.
Yes.
And, you know, conservation of energy. Energy can never be destroyed, only transmuted. So, hey, maybe they're getting some kind of energy source out of hanging out around volcanoes, underwater, above water. Even many reports of them going into volcanoes in Hawaii, I've heard, all over South Pacific in different areas where there is heavy volcanic activity. I've heard many reports of UFOs. Mount Shasta up north here in California, Mount Lassen, there's heavy UFO activity in both of those areas. In fact, there's even a cult up in Mount Shasta. I won't say cult, a large group of individuals who have a very strong belief that there's an underground society living inside the mountain there at Mount Shasta.
Yes.
Excuse me. So, and that's, you know, old tradition that's been handed down for years. Who knows? Maybe there is. Just because we don't have the technology to fly into a mountain doesn't mean that someone else doesn't.
That's so true as well. I think we have more opportunity now to take photos because everybody carries a phone now with them. And a lot of these phones have got high resolution. So you can take a photo of a UFO. You know, I'm surprised
that's absolutely true.
I'm surprised, but a lot of people say, oh, I saw a UFO. And I thought, where's your phone? Surely you've got your phone with you. If I saw something, I'd reach for my phone straight away and try and take as many photos as I can before it disappears.
And I'm glad you brought that up, Bob, because it just so happens we had a large event here June 4th this year at an event called Contact in the Desert. I have 8 reports filed into MUFON that came across my desk. I'm taking 7 of them myself, and I gave one of them to one of my field investigators, Earl Anderson, to handle, otherwise known as Earl Gray. He's going to look into that one for me.
Right.
But, apparently 7 to 10 orbs were sighted shortly after 10 in the evening by over 100 people at Skywatch there at Contact in the Desert. And I'm just looking into this case, so I don't have a lot of details, but I think it's remarkable that I have so many people from different walks of life basically filing the same story with MUFON, and I find that very credible. But not only that, I have a correlating case of an object being seen shortly after those orbs were seen, miles away, granted, but within the same flight path and going in the same direction as would be if it was leaving from there and heading out over the ocean in that direction. So who knows? Maybe there was a big ET presence there at Contact in the Desert this year. Perhaps there actually was contact at the desert.
Well, when we talk about crafts and aliens, they're always saying, but there's about 6 or 7 different alien species from different planets. Would you agree with that?
Well, no, I think that's ludicrous to say a number like that. How can that's like limiting the universe. And I'm sorry, but the universe is a staggeringly large place. And
correct,
it may have other dimensions in it, and there may be other universes. To say that there's, 5 or 7 species or 10... No, my guess would be that there's billions of intelligent species throughout the universes, throughout the areas we don't know. Many probably far more advanced than us, and I'm sure there's many that wish they were as advanced as we are. But no, they don't all drive Yugos, and they don't all come from the same place. So,
correct.
You know,
correct.
We have a very large universe out there. Just in our Milky Way galaxy, there could be more life than we could ever know in our lifetime just within our own neighborhood here, let alone all the other galaxies in our universe. You know, to look at it all, if you had the bigger picture and you look through the space telescopes and the high definition pictures that they've published of the known universe and stuff, if you can go through it on a macro voyage, it's just fascinating to look at it and to think of all the different places where the possibility of life to originate actually do exist out there in that area that we know nothing about. So I'm without
That's
a
true.
Doubt that there's many, many species that find us of interest. From many reports I have, every time atomic weapons were set off, there was repercussions throughout other galaxies, other universes that we don't comprehend, we don't know. It affected other dimensions and caused a lot of havoc and destruction. Who knows what harm we did using something that was a technology we were just learning about. I could see wholeheartedly why this area would be of interest to other races from other areas of the galactic neighborhood, especially one of the largest cities in the United States, Los Angeles, with its heavy population. Anybody who's flown into LAX, you depending on where you come from when you're flying in, if you come from Phoenix, you fly over a whole lot of desert before all of a sudden you start seeing houses sparsely, then thicker and thicker, and then all of a sudden you're just a whole metropolis of L.A. from miles away. And at nighttime...
I suppose California is a lot of desert then.
Well, it is a large part. It very, very much so. In fact, even Southern California, if it hadn't have been for Huntington and his water project, a lot of California would still be desert. I grew up in a town called Covina, and it was desert until water was brought in, and then it had the luscious orange groves around. So, yeah, things like that changed the landscape. I guess you could call it geoforming. And it changed the topography of the area as well, I'm sure. Little changes always do change geographical locations. If you change things slowly enough, change it from desert to a fertile area, over time, I'm sure the weather patterns probably change in that area as well. So, yeah, it's kind of fascinating when you think about it. And that's one of the great things about when you study UFOs, you start studying different fields as well, because there's so much you have to learn if you're going to keep track of what the UFOs are reported doing, that you really have to be multidisciplined in different faiths to make any headway in the field.
That's true, yeah. I know Russ is still with us. Is there anything you would like to add, Russ?
Well, I think Jeff's done a great job. We've had some fascinating sightings here in Arizona where a lady was followed. It was up on the reservation by Four Corners, and followed by a UFO and had a strange animal when she got to her apartment that was waiting in her parking place. It was kind of like a giant rabbit with alien eyes. But in the investigation of the vehicle, I believe it was a Toyota, they found that, one, the car had been was now radioactive and parts magnetic. And,
oh, wow.
And then a very similar thing happened in New York, and they investigated that one, and they found the composition of the oil in the engine had changed, and the metal in the engine block had changed. But
wow, that is awesome. Hey, Bob, I got to add in here. Russell was at Star Team Boot Camp with me in Wickenburg, Arizona, and he was actually on my team. We ended up winning the Top Gun Award at the competition there for the first ever MUFON Boot Camp. And Russ was an integral part of the team. He is an excellent investigator. And it was really a pleasure meeting you out there again, Russ. I'm glad you called in today. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's I've enjoyed it very much. And I had a great time at the boot camp. And, those plaques they gave us were really cool. I loved it.
I know. Mine's over my desk, man.
Yeah, that's nice.
What you have to do is put a request in for me on Facebook, Bob Brown.
Okay.
I'll accept your request, and we'll have a chat sometime.
Sounds good. Absolutely.
Excellent idea. I know Russ has some fantastic cases out there. He'd be great for the show, Bob.
Yeah, see, I thought he would be as well. And I'll get in touch with you, Russ, and we'll talk about you coming on the show.
Okay, sounds good. Absolutely.
Cool. Glad to hear it.
Yeah.
Well, we also have something I want to mention, too, before we run out of time. MUFON has a new tool for all its investigators called MUFON University. And it's a very excellent tool. Anybody interested in becoming a field investigator with MUFON, I highly recommend you go ahead and start the process, get the manual, and take the test online. But after that, the learning really begins, and MUFON University is such a great tool for you that you'll be able to become a top X investigator in no time at all using those tools there and the resources available to you. So all you MUFON people out there that are listening today, please go to MUFONUniversity.com, look at the MUFON-specific courses there, and then look at the other courses that are available that you think might help you out. And I really recommend that you take a look at it right now. It can do nothing but help you in your investigations.
That is so good as well, because I'm sure there's lots of people out there wanting to get to know a little bit more, and I'm glad you brought that subject up.
Yeah, you know, people think that we're a special breed being an investigator, and well, yeah, we are in a way, but we're not different from anyone else. We're just the ones that are asking the questions, and anybody with the interest can have the ability to ask the questions just as easily, and we provide the training to allow you to do it in the proper way and get the information that we really need critically to come to a conclusion about the phenomena that's going on around the world. You know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And that's what we're all about, is coming up with the best possible evidence. Russell, I know you're still there. Those exercises we did out there in Wickenburg sound just like the kind of stuff used in these investigations you just brought up. Especially, I remember when we were out there checking with radiation detectors and magnetometers and everything and setting up the grids. Perhaps you could tell Bob exactly how labor intensive all that was.
It was very labor intensive, because we were walking up and down, you know, small hills and in little washes, and the heat was a factor too. But setting up the grids, you had to measure it and hammer in the stakes and run the, you know, the string and stuff. And it was very labor intensive. But that's good, because if you go out to a crash site or a landing site, you know, you really need to do all that stuff.
Absolutely. And being aware of what it's going to take beforehand is just so valuable.
Absolutely. And one of the things that for the listeners to understand, if you see a UFO that's landed, I personally would caution people against going up to it, because we found that there's the propulsion systems emit gamma rays. So you can get radiation poisoning by going up to one. So we've had several cases of that too. And anytime there's been something that's been really affected by a UFO, one thing you want to do is, just for protection, is take a radiation reading before you.
Yeah, that would be my first tool of choice. Definitely. So, Geiger counter is the first thing I'd be holding out in front of me every time.
Absolutely. Because you have to make sure that the area you're walking into is safe to walk into, because it isn't always.
Right.
True, yeah. A
great example of that, I'm sure, Russ, you're familiar with the crash in Koyami, when the Mexican army tried to retrieve the object and they all died. They weren't prepared for it. Our teams had to go in and clean it up. And that was, you know, evidence right there that you don't want to be just trucking up to a UFO. As I tell people, and I even said it just yesterday, it's not all Reese's Pieces. You know,
oh, no.
They see E.T. in the movie and think he's all the cute little guy, and it's all, that's huggy-huggy, and, you know, sorry, it's not like that.
The trouble is, Jeff, if you see some at land, you automatically want to go towards it, don't you?
Well, yeah, you know, the encounters that I've had, the main one, fortunately, it was far enough above me to where I couldn't walk up to it, but it was about a mile long craft, probably at least a half mile wide, slowly going overhead about 25, 30 miles an hour. And I didn't have the inclination to run away. I didn't feel scared. And quite the opposite, I and all the other people in the market parking lot that were witnessing this, we were cheering and whistling and making comments like, oh, cool, this will be all over the news tomorrow. Now they have to admit this is going on. And, of course, Bob, you know, the next day, not a word mentioned in the news, newspapers, TV, anything. Even though it was a heavy metropolis area, the San Gabriel Valley in L.A. County, it doesn't get more heavily populated than that. Who knows how many people had to have witnessed the same craft going over. And, you know, it's funny, at the time, I was 100% convinced it was alien, even though it kind of looked a lot like, say, the ship from Battlestar Galactica, the old TV series Battlestar Galactica, with Lauren Green. It kind of looked similar to that. But and the way it took off and left was kind of similar to that. But now I think about it more, and now that I know about, well, programs going on and things that might have happened at Lockheed Corporation and Skunk Works and things like that, and thanks to comments made by their former CEO, Ben Rich, I start thinking, well, maybe it was made in Palmdale and not too far away after all. Who knows? It's totally within the realm of logic. So, yeah, maybe I saw an extraterrestrial craft that time. Maybe I saw a terrestrial craft. But one thing's for sure, I saw something with technology that the public isn't aware of. That is for sure.
True. That was nearly coming to the end of the show, Jeff. It's gone ever so quickly tonight, as usual. And thank you for Russ for ringing in. You get back in touch with me, Russ. And then I can give you a date to come on the show sometime.
Sounds great.
That'd be great. I can't wait to listen to that one.
Yes. Can you let everybody know where they can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. You can get a hold of me through the MUFON website, www.mufon.com, or you can find me on Facebook. My name is Jeff Krause. I'm the state director for MUFON Southern California. And I look forward to hearing from anyone. If you have any questions, please go ahead and get a hold of me anytime. And we can always use your talents at MUFON. Check out the website, see what we have to offer, and we can use you.
Wonderful, wonderful. And what about you, Rose?
Well, you can get a hold of me through, I have a personal website, russellasbell.com, and that's R-U-S-S-E-L-L. A-Z-B-I-L-L. There's a link there where you can send me emails, and I'm also on Facebook. So, and you can reach me through Phoenix MUFON.
Right. Thank you so much. Anyway, Jeff, thank you again for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'll have you on again in a couple of months' time, because I'm sure you'll have some new cases more. More new cases by then.
Absolutely.
And have a lovely weekend.
You as well, Bob.
And all you listeners out there,
thanks for spending time with us this evening.
Thank you. And have a nice weekend, Russ, and thank you for ringing in.
Yeah, had a great time. I enjoyed it very much.
Lovely.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. Appreciate it.
Yeah, had a great time.
Wonderful. You both take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Sounds good.
All righty.